Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? I have a lovely guest today. Sharon Van Etten is here. She's a singer-songwriter. Many of you know her. She released her breakthrough album, Epic, over a decade ago. She's got six studio albums total, including Tramp, Are We There, Remind Me Tomorrow, and her latest, We've Been Going About This All Wrong, great album. She's also been acting a bit, including roles in David Lynch's Twin Peaks, The Return, which I talked to her about, and not at all. No acting talk on this one. It's just the way it went. But it was great meeting her. We've been trying to get this to happen for a while. She doesn't live that far from me. She's a lovely guest for many reasons, outside of her talents and how pleasant it was to hang out. But she brought me gifts. She brought me a nice bag of fresh coffee from a roaster near her over in her neighborhood and a nice to-go cup thing for my car or wherever I want to take it that keeps it hot. That's not nothing. That is not nothing, showing up with presents. So it was great to talk to her, and you'll hear that shortly. So I'm on reservation dogs. It dropped yesterday. You can watch that. I just watched it. I think I did a pretty good job. I think I was pretty funny. I think I was pretty me. I was hairy. I was had a little bit of crankiness to me. I think that I had a couple of funny moments. The show is, I love the show, but I'm on there. And it was one of the great, great fun acting experiences. It was probably the most fun I had acting ever. Just riffing it out, making some funnies, being this guy. I didn't think I could be the guy, but it turns out I was the guy. It was good. Go watch it. What else can I tell you? A lot of you are hearing me complain about, not complain, but my fear of fascism and drought. Neither seems that they can be solved or stopped. But I don't think I'm crazy about either. But the drought thing, because I talk to people here. I mean, we all cherry pick the news we see, or we all compartmentalize or contextualize the stories we read. But I don't think I'm freaking out unnecessarily about the water situation. Like, I'm literally in a panic almost every day about when do I need to get out of here? I mean, it's not even so much about getting my money back on my house. It's just about getting out before the fucking water panic. And look, not for nothing, Liquid Death has been sending me like two cases every 2 weeks. I don't know why. They don't sponsor anymore, but they just keep sending them, and I'm not going to stop it because I got a stockpile now. I've got plenty of water for almost everything I need for at least a week, and I've got carbonated water if I want to try bathing in that or showering or whatever, brushing my teeth with carbonated water. I can do that because of Liquid Death. This isn't a plug. This is a reality. But my thing is, really, is that they're not going to tell us. That's my fear. It's like I told Brendan, my producer, that we're going to be out of water by, you know, the middle of summer. And he's like, really? You think that the largest economy in the United States is just going to run out of water in 2 months? I'm like, yeah, kind of. And Okay, maybe I'm off by a month or two, but it's happening. But I just don't think they're going to tell us when it's actually happened. I mean, you think the state of California is just going to be like, yeah, everybody, you might want to think about packing up. You got about 2 months. You got about 6 months. I'd get out of the state. All of you, stores, everything. The only people that should live here are people that don't need water. Whoever those people are. Only reptiles can remain. But that's my concern, is that who's going to tell us that the jig is up? Can I say that? Is that slang in a bad way? Who's going to tell us that game over? We're just going to get like an alert, like I just got on my phone. Like you get those Amber alerts, you get weather alerts, you get missing elders alerts, missing senior citizens. Those alerts on your phone, you're like, what's happening? What's that sound coming out of my phone? It's just going to be one day, it's just going to say, water gone, good luck, Gavin. In New Zealand, having great time, Gavin. Hashtag winning. Get out now. Traffic terrible. Can see it from my helicopter. Gavin. That's what that day is going to be like. That's the day before everything really goes to fucking hell. One other thing in personal news here. Charlie Beans Roscoe, the cat that I found under my stairwell out back when he was about 2 weeks old and abandoned by his mother or in the process of being moved or whatever, I grabbed him and the rest of that family is gone. Could not find them. She took, I don't know what happened to them. Can't be good. But Charlie moved in a couple of days ago and sure enough, within 2 days of living here, he had, you know, diarrhea and he threw up and I took him to the vet and I spent like $600 for x-rays and medicines and parasite medicines and this and that. And I got him home and he's acting pretty chipper. That's sort of the baptism for me. Also there's like, we're not sure about this x-ray. He's young. It's hard to get definition. Maybe there's, it's like, it never, like, why? He's okay. I just got to ride this out though. It's almost like, you know, welcome the new cat. Here you go. Veterinary panic. I'll keep you abreast of the situation. We don't know if there's blockage, but I freaked out entirely because that's what I do. It's just, it's amazing the zone you get into, that sort of cortisol groove of just getting a cat to the vet. This cat's a kitten, so there's no problem driving him there, but just all the fear and panic and why my cat and what the hell's happening. And then it's relatively inconclusive. You just have to wait. I guess it's the same with people. But he's a cute guy, and I assume that if he lives, Buster and Sammy will take turns beating the shit out of him until he understands who's boss. And that's also not unlike taking a cat to the vet office, seeing that kitten get beat up, and all his joy and kittenness just get pushed around by a couple of old guys. So he knows his place and behaves properly relating to them. Heartbreaking. And then they just turn into fat old cats. So look, Sharon Van Etten is great. I love her music and I like this new album a lot. And the new record is called We've Been Going About This All Wrong. And it's available now wherever you get music. And this is me talking to her. When I'm listening to your stuff and I'm looking who's on the albums and stuff, I realize, like, fuck, I'm old. You know, I'm old and I'm missing an entire generation of people. But I have the records. I don't always lock in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still learning. I feel like coming, you know, being new to LA still, yeah. I feel like we moved here in September of 19.
From where?
From New York.
Yeah.
And so it's like a whole new scene out here.
Oh, really?
I kind of still feel like the new kid, even though I'm in my 40s. It's kind of a funny place to be.
Yeah. And who was in the scene in New York? Who was hanging around?
Well, when I first started, it was like TV on the Radio had just gotten their big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was that was who I got introduced to at first.
Yeah.
But then it was Grizzly Bear was around. Mm. And
this is back in the day?
Yeah. It was
like 2000 what?
Like 4.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Grizzly Bear. I kind of remember them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I missed them too.
Yeah. I think they're...
on the radio, they got through.
Yeah. Yeah. And Dave Siddick's out here now doing a lot of cool production stuff.
The guy from TV on the radio?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. One of them.
One of them?
Tunde has a... Like, he's done some acting now.
Yeah.
And he has a solo record, I think, either about to come out or just came out. But...
Huh. But then I'm looking at your records and I see that woman, Meg Baird.
Oh, yes.
I know her.
She's
I have her
beautiful.
Records. Great
yeah.
voice.
She's one of, like, she's like old school Philly circle for me. Like, my first couple of records were.
Is that her on Sing on the Harmony, a lot of them?
She did on Epic. She yeah. sang like a lot of psychedelic stuff through one of those Space Echoes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she went to town.
Yeah.
We stayed up late the night before listening to Lush. And
oh, that'll do it, I guess.
Yeah.
Epic, that second record?
Yeah.
All right, so let's see. You come from where?
Jersey.
You're a Jersey person.
Yeah.
Full Jersey.
You're born there, right?
I'm genetically Jersey. And I think I'm close to you.
Yeah.
Like, my mother's from Pompton Lakes.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Pompton Lakes, Pompton Plains.
Pompton Plains, yeah.
I worked at in my early 20s when yeah. I moved back home with my parents, I worked at an animal shelter near, where was it? In Orange?
Uh-huh.
In, like, East Orange or yeah. something?
Yeah. Pompton Lakes, I just remember Willowbrook Mall.
Oh, sure. The big mall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Paramus Park Mall. Where was I? Morris County? I don't know what county.
Okay.
That was.
Yeah, that was Essex.
Wayne.
Oh, Wayne.
Do you
sure.
know where Wayne is? Yeah, Wayne. Yeah. I heard the shore. I heard the Jersey and the shore. Sure.
The shore.
You're sure, the word. I heard Jersey.
Yeah. Well, I always said the beach, but like my dad, who's born and raised Jersey, still Jersey. Never will leave.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't know, like, the shore that everyone talks about.
The Jersey Shore?
Like, there's so many shores.
We used to go, I have family down the shore, but by Deal Beach.
Deal?
Yeah, Deal. And it was like, at the time, back in the day, a lot of Persian Jews now, but now, it used to be like where the big mobsters used to have big houses on the beach.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of weird big beaches down there, lot of big houses.
Okay.
I was just down there, actually, to visit. It's in Monmouth County.
Oh, sure. I have family in like Asbury, Brielle.
Right. It's right there, right near there. My grandparents lived in Asbury.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I love that. I love that area.
It's got, like, I drove through it for the first time. My grandparents, towards the end of it, lived in that one high-rise building there. Was it for old people? It's sort of at the end of the boardwalk.
Okay.
But now they redid the whole place.
Have you performed at Count Basie before?
Yeah. I was just there.
Oh, cool.
You?
Yeah, I've been there. I remember in the 90s, there was this show called the Christmas Charity Love Bash.
Yeah.
And it was like the Whirling Dervishes, Evan Dando, The Murmurs, and Frente.
Evan Dando.
Yeah. He was my first crush.
With the Lemonheads.
Oh, yeah.
What happened to Evan Dando? I don't think that's a great story for some reason.
He's not doing well, it doesn't seem.
Do you see him around?
I mean, just, you know, Twitter and messages that people write when they're spiraling.
Oh, really?
It bums me out, you know.
It's a business.
Yeah.
It's the business.
Yeah. You got to document everything, apparently.
The nature of our business is there's going to be spirals.
Right.
And there's going to be, like, there's a whole generation of people where you're like, what happened to that guy? And it wasn't that long ago.
Mm-mm.
And it's never a great story, but they keep pushing along somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen to that guy, but I get messages from people. I'm like, uh-oh. I was just thinking about a guy yesterday. I'm like, I better text that guy because I haven't heard from him.
Yeah, I'm rooting for you. You know what I mean?
You can do it.
I want you to do well.
Well, I think that when you come up in a scene, like I think that time of the Lemonheads and that whole world, like I was in Boston back in the, in the 80s. And I think when you have a scene, and then whoever comes out of that scene and becomes a big star, they kind of get established. And then everyone else is kind of fighting it out.
Right.
And then when you really kind of like, really are no longer part of anything anymore, I think it's kind of hard on the ego. And you don't really know where to go. And if you have substance and alcohol abuse issues. It's compounded.
Yes. I mean, I think about, you know, I kind of came into music at a time where I kind of missed the height, you know, getting in at a good point.
Of alt rock or of the original kind of post-punk scene?
Well, even just like the days of like getting signed and what that means.
Right.
And the support behind it in this other
pre-internet
way. Yeah.
Right. When A&R guys would find you and make you.
Yeah, and you'd fly all over the world.
Right. And you'd get $2 million of money, millions of dollars to do a record for a year.
Yeah, that doesn't really exist anymore. But I'm glad in a way that I didn't start up here.
Because now
I think a lot of kids that are being found through TikTok and other ways, and they set the bar so high, but it's like, how do you sustain something if it starts all the way up here? I feel for them.
I don't know. Yeah, but I don't even know how many people of a generation kind of dig in the same way that we did. Like, you know, like, even give a shit necessarily about the history or what we come from, you know, musically. I think a lot of younger people learn a trick and they do it and they nail it and all their talent goes into this moment and then they just sort of ride that for as long as possible. Whereas I think it seems like you, I think that there was a time where people really paid their dues and figured out who they were. And I don't know if that happens anymore, does it? Am I being old man again?
I mean, I think there are still kids that their main thing is they want to tour.
Yeah.
Which...
play the rock music.
It makes me blush. Just like, that's the sweetest thing in the world. Because that's all I never thought I would have a career at all. I just liked playing and I always had a job, you know.
Right.
And I used to book my own shows through Book Your Own Fucking Life. I don't know if you ever heard
of that.
What
was that?
It's called BYOFL.org.
Yeah.
Like MapQuest era.
Uh-huh.
Where like people would post about their houses or DIY spaces, and you'd write them directly, but they would say like which genres they preferred.
Oh, wow.
If they would
to
put
stay
you
at
up
your
or
house?
Not. Like I would drive across country by myself in my car and just like throw a guitar in the back and maybe have a buddy so I wasn't alone, but like just driving across country.
And that would set up the gig too?
Yeah.
So it was sort of like what used to happen in punk rock with zines and with that network of people who when punk rock was... you know, barely known. So they'd come over here and it'd just be the fans who would take care of everything.
Exactly.
Right. So I didn't realize they had a website at some point in time.
Yeah, I think it's defunct now, but I remember
very clearly
being a solo folk artist opening up for like this metal show in like Worcester, you know?
Worcester! I remember Worcester. There used to be a comedy show at a place called Margaritaville in Worcester. Worcester was heavy, man.
Yeah.
But okay, so when you were growing up in New Jersey, huge family?
I'm one of five.
Middle?
And? Middle of the middle.
Really? So there's two on either side of you?
Yeah, so there's an older brother, older sister, me.
Yeah.
Little sister, little brother.
Holy shit.
All 2 years apart.
And what'd your folks do?
My mom... well, she stayed at home until I was in sixth grade and going to night school. And by the time I was in sixth grade, she got her master's in teaching at Montclair State.
Montclair.
And we moved.
Teaching what?
History.
Ah.
So she went from being a history teacher to the head of the department.
Really?
Yeah.
After five kids, she went to... wow.
She's and what, a badass.
And your dad, they're not married or they are?
They still are.
Wow.
Which is shocking. I don't know how they made it through.
Did you not think they would make it? Do they still like each other?
They do, I think. but you know, like I'll call them to check in and they'll be in, like they have a house in Maine where my sister lives and has a farm. And, and she has three kids, so they like to help out. They're newly retired.
Is that do all your sibs have kids?
No, one does not, but he has a beautiful St. Bernese Mountain Dog.
Oh, okay. Because I think the grandparents gravitate to the kids.
Yes. They chose their child.
Oh, they did? you have one.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know. Could you see your parents moving out to like Highland Park?
That would be a good show. but no, my parents like to travel. Yeah. So I think, you know.
They come out?
They have, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And how old's your kid?
He's five.
Five.
Yeah, just started kindergarten.
Wow.
Yeah, big time.
How's that going? Are you enjoying the parenting process?
It's, I don't feel qualified yet.
Does anybody? I mean,
I mean, yet? I mean, you're doing it. You're all the wiring has been laid. He's five.
Yeah. I mean, we're totally screwed. He's a really great kid.
Oh, that's good.
He's a skater, a drummer. He can play every sport already.
Really?
And he, you know, he's traveled with me a little bit, and he loves the bus.
Oh yeah.
He's in love with my drummer Jorge, and Jorge even gave him lessons during the pandemic. And,
oh really?
Yeah. And he loves traveling, and school now, he's kind of bummed out because he's realizing that it's going to be all the time.
Oh yeah, this is what it is.
Yeah, it's not just for the week. It's not camp anymore. You know.
This is your life.
For a long time now.
So when you started playing, you referred to you do see yourself as a folk musician at the beginning, in a way?
I mean, the
just you
cliche
and your guitar?
Of the girl and a guitar, you know.
That was you.
That was me.
Yeah.
But I hit it pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know, like I was a banger, but I had a range. So I feel like people didn't understand what I...
Who made you think you could do that? Like, what were you listening to that you said, like, I'm going to be that?
I mean, my musical taste was like all over the place, but
But you chose just to be a guitar person.
Well, I mean, I gravitated towards guitar after piano because it was easier to
travel with,
you know. I liked a lot of music. I was my dad had all his rock records growing up, and
Old man rock.
Like, well, some of it, but he liked Neil Young and the Beatles and the Kinks, Jethro Tull.
Oh yeah, sure, sure, Jethro Tull. Yeah. Sitting on a park bench.
Bump! Don't even get me started. The Sunday drives to the hiking trail on Sundays. He would. My mom still asked him to turn the music down.
Jethro Tull, I've tried to kind of go back. It's all before me. I grew up in a weird zone where I was in high school in the late 70s. So it was just still the crashing wave of whatever happened earlier on. And then there was disco and new wave and punk sort of filtered in. But I got all that crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I was in high school when In Through the Outdoor and Zeppelin's last record came out, and we were all pretty excited. But Jethro Tull, I've tried to go back to recently. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy listening. There are a couple
silly.
Pretty songs.
Sure.
There's like Skating on the Ice of a New Day. It's like the standing on one foot flute thing is for real. And
it is. Furious flute playing.
I've seen him in concert. Ian Anderson is one of my dad's favorite performers.
Oh,
and
yeah?
Even
so you've gone with your dad.
Gone with my dad
to see Jethro Tull.
There's a beautiful theater in Jersey City actually that we went to. I can't remember the name of it, but we saw Martin Barry, the guitar player.
Oh, really?
His solo show there.
The guitar player of Jethro Tull.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of like a guy. Like he could do. He was an odd player.
Yeah.
And he could really play.
You'd really have to hang with Ian Anderson if you're going to be on board for the full JT. You know.
Oh my God.
So that was really how I got my start, was being a Jethro Tull fan.
There's some folkiness in there. There's definitely some weird Renaissance-y kind of something.
Yeah. But my mom she liked Lucinda Williams, which, you know, was a cool part of
those
what she
early
listened
records.
To. And Carole King.
Oh yeah. Yeah, my parents had Tapestry.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. It was like the record. It was just always present. I have it.
It's still good.
Of course.
It's still good.
So when do you light out on the road with your guitar? How old were you? Did you go to college and stuff?
I was a late bloomer to pushing myself as a musician.
Yeah.
After high school, I moved to Tennessee.
But were you in high school? Were you like the sad girl with the guitar?
I was actually I was quiet but goofy.
Oh,
and
good.
I was more in like... I was in musicals.
Oh,
and
that's good.
I was sporty. I did track.
Oh, yeah?
And I wrote songs, but they were... My friend Dana and I would sit on the main street in Clinton and write silly songs about, the gangster on the corner with their pants blowing in the wind. Like,
right, sure.
Ween was really big when I was in high school, and they're from the area, from the Pennsylvania side.
Did you know Ween?
I didn't know them personally, but I was a fan.
You were?
Yeah.
You like the Ween universe?
The Ween... Wait, which one's that?
No, it's just all of it.
Oh.
Ween is a universe.
Ween is a universe.
It's like you can't.
I don't know that record.
They were you can't categorize Ween. They are in and of themselves.
Absolutely. But yeah, the country record
it's great.
Was big.
Yeah.
You know, Pitch Up a Rope. And was Baby Bitch on that one?
I don't know.
But it's classic.
I didn't go deep into the Ween. I just touched the surface.
It's mood oriented for sure.
I interviewed one of them, Gene, I think.
Gene Ween.
He's out here.
Oh, no way.
I think so. Which one's not the guitar player, the other one. Dean, I think. Which one did I interview? I felt I had to take the opportunity. Hold on. Let's see.
I used to go to New Hope, Pennsylvania, which was the next, like,
I interviewed Gene.
Okay.
Gene Ween. Dean Ween's a guitar player.
Okay.
Gene Ween, he plays guitar too, but he's the other one. He's out here. He does work in showbiz.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like New Hope was where they were from, and that there was a coffee shop I used to go to there.
It's in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, but just it's like the next town over. If you're going straight down 78 through Jersey, it's like the next town on the Pennsylvania side.
I like Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I was just in Pittsburgh. I actually was one of those moments where I'm like, I could live here.
Yeah, like there's some cool spots.
Pittsburgh's cool.
Yeah.
All right, so after high school, you just go to Nashville?
It was Murfreesboro. The Borough, as they call
Borough.
It.
Borough, yeah.
They had a recording program there.
Oh,
and
okay.
My parents were always like the backup plan. You know, you can't pursue music. I thought at the time I wanted to be on Broadway. I
was from all the musicals. Ready?
I was I knew I could sing.
Yeah.
But I my writing wasn't good. And
right.
So I felt like if I'm into music, why not go to school for music and figure out a way to learn how to record myself or other people?
Yeah.
But I had this illusion that going to college for something specifically, I would get past all the general requirement stuff. And then I started school and then I had to take math and English all over again. Yeah. And
you were done with that?
Yeah, I wasn't very inspired by it. You know, I'm like, I finally got through this. I did well in school. I was a B student,
right?
You know, and then I have to do it all over again. And I stopped after a year.
Yeah. And then what happened?
Well, I fell in love with some guy who was in an emo band.
An emo guy?
Yeah.
Like a big emo band?
No.
Like a known guy?
Like locally, I guess.
In Murfreesboro?
Murfreesboro.
Yeah.
And
how'd that go?
It was not good. but, you know, you fall in love. And I know he was my everything. And I wrote all the time and I would play open mics and... he told me that I wasn't good enough to play out and that I should keep practicing and keep writing. And
the guy who no one knows?
The guy who no one knows.
Telling you.
But it made me write a lot more at home. And whenever he would go on tour, I would sneak out and play shows locally. And
you had to sneak around
because of his judgment?
Because he was a scary guy? Or just because he was judgmental?
Yeah, he was, well, both.
Yeah.
You know, he was, you know, won't go too dark, but he was a manipulative guy, and I was easily like, you know, I get embarrassed talking about it sometimes just because.
Different life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, that's the, you know, you got to, that's the training relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
That's where, in retrospect, you go like, I know now that.
Yeah, I don't need to change for somebody else.
And there's that, right?
The things that I realized that I fought for were things that I, you know, really cared about.
And well, yeah. I mean, if you had to sneak away into the night, you know, you knew you believed in yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I ran away from that whole life. And
when you look back on it, I mean, I know it's embarrassing, but you're a thoughtful person, and you write these songs. I mean, what did you learn about relationships? Do you still believe that it was love?
I think you can. I think I fell for sure this idea of what I thought this person was. I saw him perform and I thought, wow, he has charisma. He has something, you know,
right.
And I want to be doing what he's doing.
Oh, and then
for someone to reciprocate a feeling, you know, helps.
Sure.
But looking back, when I see that I would close off myself from other people in order to, you know, make him happy, you know, because he didn't like my friends. He didn't like my music. I look back, I'm like, well, he didn't really like me.
Yeah.
He was trying to change me into something that he would be in love with. So
or just keep you, you know, in a place where he had control.
Yes, absolutely. And control is still a thing in my life that I have issues with, that I know I need to work on because of
giving up
that.
Control.
Giving up control. Yeah.
You got that codependent thing? Or you don't call it that?
Well, I think it's more about independence and like being in control of my own life.
Oh, I see.
When I think. When things feel out of control, it's because I feel like I'm not a part of my own life.
Right, right. But you don't, you've gotten over not, you know, giving up yourself for someone else to the point where it's detrimental.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. You know, whenever you feel like you're not being yourself around someone, I think that's a good red flag.
Well, I mean, it sparks, like, I've been not nostalgic, but I think a lot about my past, and I've been through a lot of relationships and stuff, and, like, you know, I think about the times where I was an asshole and why I was an asshole, so I can usually picture the other side of most women saying, like, that guy was an asshole. I'm like, yeah, I know that guy. I know that asshole. Because, like, you know, we all change in a certain way, but that weird jealousy of someone else's life, of, like, not liking someone's friends, not liking what they like, it's such a... Because it's not even thought through. It's not even about not liking it. It's just not wanting that person to have a life outside of you.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's like, I guess it's their control and then thinking they also know better than you.
But yeah. And why? I still do that. Like, I still, like, an idiot can write me an email about something that I did. And I'll be like, oh, my God, do I do that? No one even know. I'm willing to, like, you know, sit and think the whole day.
Ugh.
Over what? I don't know that person. And they just dump something into my head. And I'm like, maybe I am wrong.
Oh, Jesus. People must write you all the time. So how do you, like, because I try not to read a lot of things, but people don't know when they must know when you at somebody that you get the message, right?
Sure. If you're one of those people that reads them, yeah. If you're spending your day looking at your ats.
Do you have a fielder?
No.
No.
I read them.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are usually emails. That's not true. I don't know why I'm still so porous, you know, in the sense that, like, you know, I have a fundamental insecurity around everything. But I just have to put a shield up. I have to have self-talk around it and be like, don't let that. You don't know that person. That's, you know, that guy's got 4 followers. Are you going to be?
You know, Justin Vernon from Bon Iver used to retweet every bad tweet that someone, like, sent to him.
That's not a good policy. I mean, I can understand that you feel like that's empowering, but it's only going to...
Fuel it.
Oh, yeah. And it's just going to exponentially... That must end it in a disaster.
Yeah, I don't think he tweets anymore.
he retweeted himself right out of the game. So does a lot of the stuff that you were working on in Murfreesboro from that relationship show up in the first record? When was the Murfreesboro time?
So that was 99 until 2002. And then
that's not too bad. That's not too big a time investment.
Yeah,
it was like to be in a horrible abusive relationship.
Yeah. It's like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my sister, the saint, she flew me out of there and let me stay with her for a while in Vermont.
Airlifted you out?
Yeah.
To Vermont.
She got me the hell out of there. and she let me crash on her couch while I figured out my life because I was a mess.
Yeah.
And she encouraged me to play an open mic at the Radio Bean in Burlington, Vermont. And I made my first couple friends moving back.
Uh-huh.
And then she gave me the confidence to reach back out to my parents because I didn't talk to them for those few years. I was in
submerged.
Tennessee. I cut them out.
You did because of the guy?
Because of the guy.
Was it because of him or because of your own shame?
A little bit of both. Yeah.
That's rough because then they know something's wrong. And
they didn't approve of the guy and they didn't like me dropping out of school.
Oh, right.
And then
I
ended up getting a job at a coffee shop. And then now I'm just like a dropout teenager working at a coffee shop. But
you blew it.
But I mean, you know, they were formative years and the coffee shop was great. I made a lot, like that was my family. So it was like a little apartment and my family at this coffee shop that I'm still friends with a lot of those people that now live in East Nashville. But yeah, I cut them out for a while. It's pretty, again, another embarrassing, like they don't know me. They're just we're just blood. Doesn't mean we should, you know, they're my real family. They don't understand me. And I'm like, why are you running away from that? Your parents are you, you know?
Yeah, you are them. They are you.
And they took me in, like, no questions asked. They just said, if you need to get back on your feet, go to therapy, get a job, and go back to school for a year and try to get back on your feet. And that's what I did.
That's what you did after Vermont, after you emotionally rehabbed in Vermont, your sisters. You got the lowdown, got regrounded and kind of drooped home.
Yep. Tail between my legs, you know, this such a failure. But that ended up giving me the confidence to start playing again and writing. And
did you go to therapy?
I did go to therapy. It changed my life.
Yeah.
For sure. I didn't realize, like, I had panic attacks.
How'd they manifest? Breathing?
Well, yeah, a lot of breathing, which I disguised with smoking.
Did you give it up?
I still sneak.
You do?
I sneak, yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been so long.
Yeah, I'm trying to cut out a lot of things, but I still coffee and cigarettes, like, they're kind of my... But
I would like to cut out food entirely, but apparently that's the one thing you can't cut out entirely. Food is, that's the one I want out. I haven't smoked a cigarette in a long time.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you go back to school or you didn't?
I did. I went to Raritan Valley Community College. Mm. And
how was that?
I mean, I resisted at first, but then I took a psychology class and a photography class.
Oh, that's good. Like, you're shooting pictures?
Yeah, I got to, you know, develop my own film.
Doing the darkroom thing, black and white?
Yeah, just put on headphones and just learn how to develop.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, so I ended up taking 2 semesters of photography.
Watching the thing come to in the tray?
Yeah, and you just got to time every little tray. Yeah, it was really nice, actually.
And the psychology?
Psychology, I had, because I liked the psychology class I took in high school. Uh-huh. And my mom is actually still friends with the psychology teacher there who found me the therapist. Oh. And they're still friends to this day. And I knew it was an interest of mine.
Yeah.
Just learning how to understand behaviors.
Yeah.
Things like
How's that going?
I'm still learning.
Yeah.
You know, I've been studying psychology in pieces over the years.
Really?
To eventually get a degree to maybe be some kind of counselor. But I'm far from that.
You're doing these amazing, beautiful records, but your plan B is gonna be a therapist?
Well, I don't know if you've been on tour lately, Mark, but it's not exactly
not
easy.
Great.
Yeah, it's a hard life.
So you figure you'll record the records, you put them out, sell a little merch online, and have a few patients on the side?
Yeah, why not?
I like it.
I have to change. Maybe I'll just, I mean, I obviously realize there's holes in this plan. But.
Not really. Anybody, like, I think it's one of those things that if you get your hours in, you can do it.
Yeah.
You know, there's not, you know, you can be a therapist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a better listener than a talker.
Yeah.
But.
Well, like when you say you're studying psychology piecemeal, how does that kind of work? Like how do you do it?
Well, I'm starting, like I'm still getting an undergrad.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know, just.
Chipping away?
Yeah, chipping away. But I, you know, when I lived in New York, I went to Brooklyn College for a couple semesters. Broken up by a kid and then by getting like an acting job. And so I've taken a couple semesters there when I lived there.
Yeah.
And then when I came here, I took a couple classes at the Pasadena City College.
Oh, yeah.
And if I hit a certain, I have to fill these general requirements in order to apply to the psychology program at UCLA.
So you're still like dealing with those initial... requirements?
Yes.
Required classes that you're avoiding?
I need a science class.
You need a language?
And a statistics. I got my Spanish out of the way early.
You're just taking your time. That's good.
hobby girl.
But I like that, like, you know, you like there's this all this stuff happening and, you know, you're doing all this. But, you know, but you made a bunch of great records. But that doesn't seem to be the thing that you're focused on.
I just think... It's just getting harder to do as I'm one thing I really
to tour.
T- touring is a huge part of like being able to live as an artist,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And I just don't want to be gone that much anymore.
Yeah,
especially with a kid and a dog, and just I want after the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I want to be there with my partner.
Right. Well, I guess like during COVID, you really got to sort of lock in and realize, hey, this is all right. We can't go out of the house, but it's nice to be home.
Just figuring out what home is, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've moved so much as an adult even that, you know, I haven't lived anywhere long enough to feel like I have roots.
So you lived in Murfreesboro.
Lived in Murfreesboro.
And then you went back to Jersey.
Back to Jersey.
And then to New York City.
Then to New York.
And that's when you recorded Because I Was in Love in New York?
I recorded that in Philadelphia.
Did you live in Philly?
No, but I have like a big contingent there. And Meg Baird,
yeah.
Who played in Espers,
yeah.
Introduced me to Greg Weeks.
Yeah.
And like I met Otto Hauser, who eventually played drums with me for a little bit.
Philly crew.
Yeah.
Do you know Kurt Vile?
I know Kurt. I know Adam Granduciel or Granofsky, whatever he goes by now.
Yeah.
So like the War on Drugs guys and Kurt Vile and that
whole
circle.
So that was your crew.
I met Kurt later, but Dave Hartley, who played bass in War on Drugs, played bass on Epic.
Would they just release their third record, War on Drugs?
They have their
more. Is it their fourth?
Fourth, maybe.
Yeah, I remember. I got it. I don't know. Like I had the first two. I don't know if this one landed as hard with me as the other ones, but they're good.
Yeah, they're massive. You know, he's such a perfectionist.
Massive sound. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it seemed like they'd been a long time since that last record.
Yeah.
Because someone was working on it.
Yes. Yes. Adam was going hard.
Yeah.
He likes to go over and over. I don't know if you've met Adam before.
I don't know those guys.
But Heart of Gold. He's funny. But he, you know, he's played guitar on a couple of my records and. One solo, like he would work on it for hours,
really,
like, over and over and over.
Like again. Which records, though? Because it didn't get big until, like, I guess Tramp becomes big, right? The sound, anyways, changes.
Yeah, he played on "Are We There?"
Okay, yeah.
But Dave played bass on "Are We There?" And did he play bass on Tramp? No, he played bass on Epic.
Because like it seems like the first two records are kind of pretty intimate.
Yes.
Right?
The first one was kind of an accident.
Really? You didn't know you did it?
Well, I didn't own a tuner, and I tuned the guitar to itself, and we went to add stuff. And I knew that I wanted it to be minimal because I was touring solo, and I didn't want
You didn't have a tuner?
I didn't. I played an acoustic guitar. I didn't.
But you recorded a whole record without a tuner?
I never played with other people, but that was a very good lesson because we tried to add stuff to it and
nobody
can't.
in the booth was like, hey, lady, why don't you tune your guitar?
It was pretty chill. It was a pretty relaxed vibe.
Yeah.
And,
all right.
Yeah. But, you know, Greg Weeks, who recorded it, he wanted me to feel comfortable because I was excruciatingly shy. Like I used to get my hair cut where my bangs were in front of my face, and I was still learning how to have conversations with people and be able to look people in the eye, and I always felt like I didn't belong there. But my friend Ben Goldberg at Bada Bing Records, he introduced me to Greg Weeks.
Who's that guy?
Greg Weeks. Yeah, Greg Weeks produced the first record, and he played in a band with Meg Baird.
Okay.
And then, but Ben Goldberg, who has was my, he worked at Bada Bing, he owns Bada Bing Records, and I was an intern there when I moved to New York, and he introduced me to a lot of people to help me get my start.
So, why were you so shy? Was this a lifetime thing, or did something change? I mean, you used to do musicals. Now you can't look anybody in the eye. What happened?
Well, I think,
Was it Murfreesboro?
I was always kind of shy, quiet. I mean, I was a goofball with my friends,
right.
Of course. But then Murfreesboro added to it for sure, guy.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt unworthy because I didn't really know chords or time signatures, key signatures. I knew how to play for me.
Sure.
But then as soon as someone would want to jam with me or something, I was like, I don't know how to jam.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
and it's still a thing with me. I'm trying to learn how
jamming.
To do it better. Like, I just want to learn how to play with other people. I don't know how to do it.
Really? Me neither, actually. I'm trying to learn.
Did you grow up playing with other people?
No.
Like, just for fun?
No, I always played by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never could play with other people because I never wanted to learn other people's songs. I never wanted to learn songs.
Okay.
Like, I learned, at some point, I'd had a good guitar teacher. He taught me pentatonic scales. And I can make my way around, country leads and blues leads and stuff. And I can play chords and things. But I never wanted to play anything exactly like anybody. Like, I never wanted to learn anyone's licks.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to learn how to play Led Zeppelin perfectly. It just took too much energy. So I can play like myself. And I know a bunch of stinky blues licks. But I have a sense now. Like, I've been playing with real musicians a bit, and I like it. I appreciate it. It's very scary, though, to me. But what you knew, but so you're saying that your guitar was out of tune, so you couldn't overdub, and that's why that album's so sparse?
Yeah, it's pretty minimal. We had to, we had a bass that we put through an octave pedal that ended up being the bass because you could tune it a little bit to string
your guitar
instrument.
Right.
But when people ask, like, what tuning is this in? I'm like, I have no fucking idea. It's like D and a half or D and a third. I don't know what it is.
Almost E.
Yeah. It's like, I know how to, I mastered tuning to itself. And
Like, they have these things you can just clip on the guitar.
Yeah, now they do. Yeah. But yeah, it's embarrassing, but it's true.
But it's not embarrassing. You say embarrassing a lot. It's good. It's a good
record. It was a happy mistake, and I'm proud of it.
So then you do Epic, which is not as sparse, but still pretty. I mean, it seems like you're crafting a tone.
Learning how to play with other people.
Yeah.
Like letting the sound expand while still being me,
Well, that's interesting. So let the sound expand. But also, there's definitely, you have a very kind of consistent and evolving, though, vibe and tone to the songs. It's very, I don't know what the word is, not heavy, but there's a sort of, there's a lot of space in there. There's a lot of emotion in there that is not, I don't know how to explain it, but I like it.
Thank goodness. Oh, my gosh.
but it's like, I understand. I don't know where you met Angel Olsen or why, but it seems like, she must have been inspired by you in a sense of like there's it's not ethereal that I want. It's a heavier than that. But there is sort of a space that both of you kind of create that is a nice place to be for a while.
Yeah. I mean, which is funny because I saw you at an Angel Olsen show.
You did, yeah.
In L.A.
Yeah.
You're sitting behind me and I was too shy to say hello.
Again.
Always, forever.
Yeah.
I first heard Angel in 2011, which, a quick side note, because my partner thinks that you may have been... We did a show at Maxwell's with Ted Leo on New Year's.
Oh, really?
And he thinks that maybe you were the MC that night.
I don't know that I ever MC'd a New Year's show at Maxwell's.
Okay.
I mean, the comics are... I used to do Yolo Tango's Hanukkah shows sometimes. And I was there once with The National as the guest band. But it was not New Year's.
Okay.
But I know Ted Leo.
Yeah.
So your partner plays...
He played drums with me at the time.
Oh, okay.
And...
It wasn't me. It was some other Jew.
Some other Jew. I didn't remember and I felt bad. So
some
I didn't
other
wanna,
funny Jewish
I didn't
guy.
Not, I didn't want to not say something.
Yeah.
But in 2011, I was on my way to shoot a video for... my song Magic Chords, and Darius Van Armen, who's Jag Jaguar, was driving, and he played me some demos of Angel.
From the first records?
Yeah.
And they sound like your first record.
But I remember hearing it and being so moved, and he said, I think we're about to sign her. What do you think? And I just remember thinking, her melodies are so moving. Like her, just there's a timbre of a voice. There's something in, if someone can really sing, like Richard and Linda Thompson Oof. Does it for me. There's certain things when they hit me, I can't always explain it, but it's so emotional. And I think... what Angel and I were able to bond over during this tour we just finished.
Has she got a friend for me? That Linda Thompson song? Has she
got a friend? Oh, my God. Well, I mean, walking on the line. I mean, Pour Down Like Silver is a record you can't really find anywhere, but I really love.
Is that the both of them or just her?
It's both of them.
I don't know if I have that one.
Dimming of the Day.
Yeah. I have I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, and mm-hmm. I have the one with Calvary Cross on it.
Okay.
And I feel like I have three or four. Oh.
Yeah, her range is incredible. When I did voice lessons in Brooklyn with this woman, Joy Askew, who used to sing with...
Fairport?
She was... She sang with Peter Gabriel, and she sang with Laurie Anderson.
Okay.
But she's a vocal coach, and one of our exercises was the Dimming of the Day. It may have been Bonnie Raitt's version, though.
Huh.
Like those vocal skills are good warm-ups. They're very hard, though.
So you took the lessons?
Yes, I took lessons. I still do my exercises.
No, it's
when
good.
I can.
I took. Someone gave me one voice lesson.
Really?
Yeah.
And how'd you like it?
It was good. It made me cry. Touching sound or what? You're finding that thing in the breath. It's it makes me sad.
It's meditative.
I guess so. Once you get past the emotions. I'm very weird about singing.
Yeah. Where do you hold it?
I can open it up.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's not, but like when I hear my pure voice or when I sing in front of people, there's a vulnerability to it that I can't quite manage. And I don't, and I've always find it, there's something horrifying to me about singing badly in front of people. Like it's just so devastating. The idea of, and then having to finish the song? Like you're just singing shitty the whole song?
No.
So I've gotten a little better, you know, but, and I've made some mistakes singing out, like with people. Like I tried to do Jealous Guy and I just fucked it. But because I'm doing a comedy show as well and they know I'm a comedian, I'll stop the song and go like, I have to start this over because I'm not going to go down like this.
Yes, it's a good way to be.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
I don't have anything on the line.
Yeah.
It's not even my real gig. Anyways, but Linda Thompson, those records kill me.
Yeah.
So Angel, you heard that quality when you first heard it.
Yes. When I heard her voice, I was moved immediately.
Yeah.
And I could just tell, like some writers start with a guitar and they have chords.
Yeah.
And then they write melodies within chords. And I think she is a writer, and I tend to do this where it's a melody that is the center of the song and you play around the melody.
So
if you try to learn a song and like nothing really repeats, it's because it's really about the melody.
Right. Well, I'm a melody guy. I have a hard time with lyrics.
Me too.
You do?
Yeah.
Like I listen to them, but I can't always make them out, and I'm not going to sit and read them too often unless I really have to.
Right.
That's why it's always been weird. Like if a singer-songwriter's not speaking clearly, I can't. It's not going to happen. You know, and it takes a lot of listens.
Yes, I'm still learning how to enunciate. Even going over the last record, there was a song where my partner was like, "It sounds like you're just." You do like it just sounds like you're singing oohs and ahs on this part, but I know you're saying something. But there's certain notes that I won't hit if
Which
I'm
song?
Speaking. Born.
That's the best song.
Oh, it's a hard one. It's a hard one for sure.
But it's got that turnaround in it that I like, those three chords. I don't remember what they are, but I know there's a certain magic three chords where I'm always like, oh. That's what I listen to that every time I listen to the new record. When I get to that song, I'm like, this is the one. But I don't know what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I kind of know.
I'd rather hit the note than say the words like if I over articulate, sometimes that distracts from the moment. But you know, that's why I do printly. I put lyrics in all the records if people want to read them.
I read them, but still, even sometimes with lyrics, like I always, I know. I just talked to that woman, S.G. Goodman. Do you know her? You should listen to those two records. Like, you know, your records kind of, you know, took me and her records. She's got two records out. She's from Kentucky.
Okay.
And it's pretty great stuff. And like, I don't know where, you know, some people just send me the records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that was, I don't know who her people are. Same people as Isbell's people. They have the same manager. But like, I don't know what it is. It's not a matter of what she's saying. It's just a matter of how she's singing it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's but you know that about yourself.
Well, you can feel that in people.
Right.
Right.
We need words for it. You know, just make the noises.
Yes.
You
know? Also, it helps people connect to it in their own way, too, you know.
I've just always been a riff or melody person. And then, like, if I can, you know, I'll lock in. But also, if there's too many words, I get exhausted. And I don't want to have to keep going back.
Yes. I forget words all the time.
You do?
Yeah.
To your own song?
Yeah. There's too many words.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's why Connor Oberst, who I talk to, there's a lot of words there. That guy's writing songs all the time. He seems to have a knack for it, but I can't. It's too much.
I need to start repeating phrases more often.
Right.
Yes.
So, all right. So, when do you start, like, because like I was saying, you have a tone, and the first few two records are pretty minimal, but then Tramp gets bigger, and now where we're at now with We've Been Going About This All Wrong, it's very big. It's a very big sound. You know, there are moments there where, like, I'm reminded of people, of, you know, like Radiohead a little bit sometimes. Sometimes PJ Harvey sometimes. These are good people. I'm not saying you're lifting anything, but
no,
I'm just saying.
I admire them for sure.
you feel that in you? You have them in you somewhere?
Yeah, I definitely grew up listening to them and their influences. And I know it all seeps in. You know, I don't deny any of that stuff.
But the weird thing is, it's still uniquely your own. But PJ did it too. Like, eventually the production gets bigger once you have more confidence, I guess, in what you're trying to do.
Right.
And it seems like you folded in, there's, like, you know, synthesizers now.
Yeah.
All kinds of layers.
Yeah.
Was that the War on Drugs guys idea?
From my last record, Remind Me Tomorrow, I was learning how to do more marriage of, like, I got bored of, like, straight up band stuff. And I felt like I was going to write the same song over and over again if I had my guitar, because I kind of got stuck in, like, this is where you go here.
Right. How do you get out of that?
Well,
bring in synthesizers.
I got a couple synthesizers because I, you know, my first instrument was piano.
Yeah.
But now, like, I have these pads and these gnarly sounds, and it's making me sing in a different way.
Yeah.
Also, after having a kid and my stomach was kind of ripped apart from, like, an emergency C-section, and so my voice kind of changed, and how I sustained notes changed, and, like, I kind of just sat, like, lower in my voice. And,
well, yeah, on Born, it's, like, really low,
uh-huh.
Right?
Uncomfortably. So.
Yeah, but it's, like, it's interesting.
Oh, cool.
I love that song. And I'm sort of like, you know, what's she doing with her voice?
Well, it was a conversation because, like, I remember someone saying, like, are you sure that's not too low for you? And I'm like, well, I think that's kind of cool. Like,
it is.
It makes you kind of sit for a second.
It does.
In that.
It's sort of like, okay, this is,
yeah.
She means business.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that this record, I wanted to embrace the, you know, the pandemic and all of the intensity and apocalyptic feelings.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to stray away from it and make, like, a fun record. So I probably leaned into it.
I'm sorry. Is there a fun record that I missed?
Well, you know, I'm like, one day I will maybe make something that's a little bit more lighthearted, but the timing didn't seem appropriate, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So everyone's like, are you going to make, like, a kids record? I'm like, hell no, I'm not making a kids record. But I don't know. I've had conversations with other artists about how they, you know, how do you not make a pandemic record if you wrote it in the last couple of years?
Time is time. When you wrote it, right?
Yeah.
And the themes are going to come through if you're just sitting there.
Yeah, I'm not going to avoid it. I kind of go there.
Do you feel like, do you have songs about it? What's the songwriting process? How does that happen?
I mean,
does it just come to you? Do you just wake up and, like, oh, yeah, here's the thing. Here's some words.
It was the first time I had a space to work out of from the home. And
you have a studio at the house?
Yeah, there was a studio in the garage.
Yeah.
And
was it there when you got there?
Yes.
Ah.
We fixed it up to make it a little bit, like, more light filled because it was covered in black foam. And I was like, I'm not moving from a basement in Dumbo to, like, a cave in LA. I'm like, I need some light, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a great space.
Okay.
And so I was able to go to work.
Oh, so, like, in it makes the writing process different because you can hear sounds right away?
Yeah, and right. I just had it to be able to click and record and to uh-huh. be able to track without knowing what I was going to do. And I don't tend to sit down and say, this is what I'm going to write about.
Yeah, me neither.
They start as kind of therapy sessions of like emotive, like singing.
Stream of consciousness, oh, and singing?
Mm-hmm.
Really? You'll just come up with words?
I mean, it starts as nonsense.
Really?
It starts like with feelings and vibe, and I find a key.
And you do that by yourself?
And I do it by myself. I hate writing around other people.
Why would they would? I. How could you be comfortable if that's your process?
Yes.
If you're just sort of, you know, jabbering away.
Yeah, it's a weird position to be in.
And you just start rhyming, or what? When do you know that like something moves from nonsense to lyric?
Well, I'll record if I figured out something melodic with a chord progression.
Right.
I'll record it for about 20-30 minutes, and I'll just keep going, and sometimes words and phrases just pop out.
Okay.
And I'll leave it for a while, and I'll kind of, if I feel good in that, you know, whatever I caught in that, whatever that thing is,
yeah,
then I'll keep going with other ideas like that, and I'll just bank them and bank them and bank them while I'm in this feeling zone. And then I won't listen to them for maybe weeks or months, sometimes years, because I just keep this folder of ideas. And on days where I go to work and I'm not feeling anything,
yeah,
I'll put on headphones and I'll listen, and that's when I'll start writing.
Huh. Years.
Sometimes.
What song has been sitting around for years?
It hasn't seen the light of day yet. Well, actually, Darkish on this record was one I had for a few years.
Huh.
The really minimal one with just the birds in the background. Because I felt like it was, at the time, too apocalyptic to release.
When you first did it.
When I first did it.
But now that the apocalypse is here.
Yes, and
you're
happening.
Like, it's time.
This
yeah.
is actually, in the context of this record, it's actually the lightest part of the record.
Wow.
But there's some things that just are sometimes just too personal or like too intense, where I'm like, I'm glad I wrote that for me, and I needed that for whatever headspace
too
I was
raw?
In. Some of it's too raw. Yeah, huh. Just like I'm maybe too literal because I'm working out my own feelings of something that happened, or, you know, I'm just
right.
like, maybe I'll, you know, sometimes songs take different forms where like a piece of it will come up subconsciously in another idea. And
too literal, like you don't want to be a storyteller?
Kind of. But also, it's not always a story that people want to hear.
How do you know?
I mean, it's hard to write songs about being a survivor, and it's hard to write songs about
a survivor.
A survivor. I'm a rape victim.
Oh.
And I still haven't really gone there in my music. And,
when did that happen?
In Tennessee, in the early 2000s.
Which
is another reason that helped me leave.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm
made
sorry
me want
to
leave.
That. But, so that was part of the reason why you were so shattered for so long.
Yeah.
And had a hard time getting your confidence back.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Terrible. Sorry that happened to you.
Yeah. But see, that wouldn't be a funny, like, it wouldn't be a song that I don't know how to write yet. I
uh-huh.
feel like.
You don't think it's made its way in at all?
I'm sure it has. And, you know, over the years, I think I avoided talking about it early because
yeah.
I was like, that's just, you know, that's going to be something that will be part of the story forever, and I don't want that to be the story.
Was it someone you knew?
No.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, well, I get it. So some things are just too heavy for you to process.
Yeah.
And until you get a handle on how you want to sort of contextualize it, it's still kind of emotionally dangerous to unpack.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can totally understand that, because it also is, it speaks to your ability as an artist too, because a lot of times, you know, people will throw stuff out there because they just need to, but you seem to know enough about the therapeutic nature of your process to know what to share and what not to share. Like sometimes, like as a comic, I'll just go out there with stuff that is clearly not funny and clearly raw and fucked up, and I'll just lay it out. And it re-traumatizes you.
I'm sure.
And I would imagine that's the risk of not having control of your personal feelings and whatever the narrative is around your trauma, to put it out in the world. Because if it goes out in the world and you weren't ready to put it out in the world, whatever comes back, mm-hmm. especially if it's negative, it's just going to, you know, reopen all the wounds.
Right. Well, I think as... Well, for me, if it, yeah. learning how to be an artist or learning how to control your narrative is yeah. so huge, right?
Yeah,
right? I mean, I'm sure you've had to deal with like being interviewed and steering conversations.
I'm not good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, because I'll talk too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what my, fortunately for me, my narrative is controlled because I never shut up. I talk twice a week and I'm very open. So there's not a lot missing from the public narrative.
You're very good at it.
Oh, well, thank you. but yeah, I understand that some people are controlled. Like, what is your fear? Like, what do you have to control now in terms of, like, when you're conscious of it?
Right. Well, things that I try to control now are, like, mostly for safety measures for family stuff. And that I'm learning, like, what I should and should not say just for... protecting people.
Right. In terms of your personal life.
Yes. Which
right.
my whole entire career has only been writing about my personal life. And,
yeah.
But now when other people become involved and people reaching out to my family members and stuff, I'm just
right. Yeah.
I need to do things a little differently.
You always be wary of the guy who's writing the big profile and needs to talk to all your brothers and sisters and parents.
Yes.
Because, you're not going to win on that one.
No, there's a lot of sides.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
So do you feel like with this record, because like for me, and I've listened to all the records in a row, like this one seems to be the most, it's the biggest sounding. And there's, you know, there's a lot of things going on musically in a lot of the songs that creates layers of heavy feeling. And it seems, I can see it as the one, it's a natural evolution and it sort of like seems to be what you're working towards. Like, do you feel like I did it?
I do, especially after the last few years that we've all gone through.
Yeah.
To be able to make anything, I think I'm proud of all my artists community that they're still making things and they keep going.
Sure.
You know, I'm so lucky that I have an outlet to
yeah.
be able to feel like something came over the last couple of years. But it took so many people to help me make the sound because it started in my little garage.
Yeah.
And then I knew that I wanted to salvage those tracks so that it still represented this time. And I didn't want a big producer to come in and like try to polish it. I wanted to pull in those tracks from my studio.
Yeah.
And I had another session with my friend Zach Dawes, who played bass on Remind Me Tomorrow. He brought me into the Village Recorders with a few session players.
Yeah.
And
where's that?
I think it's not quite Santa Monica, but it's like
here,
Fleetwood's studio where they did Tusk.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And I got to go like after hours. He had a friend that was an engineer there that's like took me in like off session.
Yeah.
God,
you could have probably got Lindsay to play on it if you wanted to.
dream. but so we had like a few sessions in there when I was figuring, like testing the waters of what I wanted the record to sound like. And I felt like that was going to be a beautiful record, but I wasn't ready to make that record. And so we brought in some of those tracks from that session to honor the players that were a huge part of it. And I mixed the garage sessions and the Village sessions with my engineer, Dan Knowles, who
uh-huh.
has done our live sound for the last few years. And he helped me do these rough mixes. And we brought him into a studio in Glassell called Balboa. And I brought in my band for the first time. And we were all in like a room together pretty much.
For the first time since the pandemic?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And so they were able to, well, everyone but my bass player, Devin, who's in Jersey City. But they came in and helped me build upon these tracks. And so it was kind of, we call it piecemeal, but piecemeal.
Yeah.
but I wanted to honor the garage and I wanted to honor my friends that were part of that studio. And then I wanted to bring in my band so we could feel like we were making something again. And I think it kept growing and growing because of that.
Yeah. And when you talk about like therapy or because I was thinking about the idea of, you know, art as, you know, expression and then as creating a therapeutic space. And when you talk about, you know, your process is being therapeutic almost in a meditational way, right? Through repetition and opening it up and taking that private space. Even though the songs have a sort of melancholy to them, they serve to create relief, right? In you.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I still don't understand it. I mean, I think this is something, and if there's some part of psychology that I can study to understand what it is, it's not necessarily the music therapy, but there's something that is like ineffable, you know, that I feel like I get it out, and it's this feeling, and it's not like it's closure or anything, but it's like this thing that I don't know what it is, and I get it out, and it's draining in a great way most of the time, but I don't know what that thing is. But I know when I've gotten it out, and I can take a deep breath after I've written something, and I don't know what it is yet, but it's this idea,
an emotional frequency, like it seems like a pretty full idea, because it's not just a lyric, you know, it's some sort of, like, you know, it comes from this secret place, a melody or just, you know, a groove of some kind, right?
Right. But even when you were saying earlier that, you know, when you sit by yourself and you try to sing, and it can make you tear up.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I get teared up when other people sing sometimes.
I think that's like a really important connection. I don't know what it is, but I can sit at a piano. And I remember even this feeling from the kid when, like, we moved into our house in Nutley when I was maybe in kindergarten.
Yeah.
And I was sitting at the piano, and I just remember feeling the vibrations and feeling something that I didn't understand, but it felt beautiful. And when you find that note, like, everyone has a note in their body, that if you find this one note, you can feel it vibrate more than other notes.
Yeah.
I think when people chant, they find that note. And there's something in that resonates with me.
Sure. It's like it's universal, and you know, it transcends language. There's a magic to it, you know, that is essentially human. And there is, you know, the combination of vulnerability and transcendence in it. Yeah.
Have you ever met someone that said they don't listen to music?
Not that I know of.
I just had an airport ride recently, and the driver said, yeah, I don't really listen to music, because every time I listen to it, I get angry.
Oh,
like,
yeah?
What kind of music what are you listening to? Can I make you a mixtape or something?
The wrong music.
I felt bad for that person.
Because I was thinking, like, when I dated a painter, you know, she was kind of a heavy being, heavy soul, but she would paint these amazingly, almost, you know, colorful, kind of simple but powerful paintings that were kind of, you know, uplifting in some weird way. And I realized at some point, or she may have told me, that, you know, that's almost a treatment for her own anxiety and depression, is to manifest this light, you know, on these canvases somehow. And I guess, you know, manifesting anything when it's coming from a place of fear, depression, trauma, whatever, it's better almost to put it out in the world without an explanation, and without it necessarily making sense in the way that people try to make sense of things. Because then it you don't have to answer for it, and it's pure. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, when I watch my kid just draw, you know, I wish I didn't have a filter, you know, because if I didn't have the filter, then I feel like I wouldn't hold so much inside, you know.
But
that's what these things that don't have words yet for me, that there are, like, I wish I could paint, and I wish I could have, like, use my hands in a way to see it. You know, like, what is, how do I organize this internal chaos.
Well, I mean, you do your thing. You know,
you do you.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, what do you want to learn to paint now?
No.
You
know,
like, that's the problem when you're an artist and it's, you know, you have your thing and then you see other things. So you're like, well, maybe I could do it better that way. But then you got to learn that. You know, then you got to judge yourself all over again. And start, I don't know.
Yeah.
Seems rough.
Yeah. We worked so hard to be where we are today and doing what we do.
Yeah.
You know, there, I have so many interests, but I, you know, there's not enough time.
Some things you got to keep as a hobby.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the way I look at guitar. Like, I used to do a joke about it. Like, you know, like, because I never set out to be a professional musician, none of these guitars are broken dream vessels. They don't represent any sort of failure to me.
They look pretty happy.
But speaking of, I think that, like, when you talk about trauma and about whether or not you can deal with it in music, I think it comes out. Like, if you're doing it the way you're doing it, it's all there. It has to inform it.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. I'm trying to be honest about my life while also telling us, having a narrative that is still general enough for people to be able to relate to if they're listening to the words. And I feel a lot better having made this. I feel like I let something go.
Yeah.
You know, it's like honoring this time and hopefully moving past it.
So you're not going to tour on this record?
Well, we did. I did a three-week tour in Europe, a month-long tour in Europe.
How was it?
Oh, my God. It was, I mean, my band is amazing, but it was a fucking nightmare.
Really?
Because... Okay, so with everything with COVID, there's a lot of supply demand issues.
Yeah.
We had reserved this bus about a year ago.
Yeah.
And it was like the last bus standing. And I'm not even used to touring on buses. The last tour we did was in 2019, and that was my first bus.
Uh-huh.
I was always a van person. Then it went van to a trailer. Then it went to like the bandwagon thing, you know?
Yeah.
Bandigo, bandwagon, both of them. And living on a bus is just hard anyway. I still don't know how to do it. But I feel very lucky to be at a bus level, quote unquote.
Uh-huh.
But we arrived in Spain. We started in Portugal.
Yeah.
And my tour manager let me know that, you know, there are some really long drives happening, so you have to have a relief driver.
Yeah.
And the relief driver shows up to meet this bus, where apparently Parliament was on the bus for 6 weeks on this bus.
Yeah.
And the driver goes to relieve this other driver to pick up the bus and bring it to us. But the driver took one look at the bus and said, fuck this, I'm out. And ditched the tour. And the driver that was on tour for 6 weeks with Parliament felt the need to stay on so that we could have this tour, because otherwise we would have been totally fucked. And so he drove the tour bus to Portugal to meet us. And when we drove from Portugal to Spain for Primavera, we felt him swerving. And it took us 5 hours longer than we were supposed to get to the place, because he had to pull over every 30 minutes or so to take a nap. Because he was exhausted.
Oh, my God.
And he's like, we're like, it's already scary to like have, you know, you're like 10 bodies flying through the night like with a stranger driving you around the world. I hate it.
Yeah.
And he was so tired, he had to pull over to nap the whole entire way. And after talking to my tour manager, he said, okay, how about this? Why don't we give him an extra day?
Yeah.
Because there was a bus and a truck, and the truck had all our gear.
Yeah.
So we let the bus driver sleep an extra day, and we just had met the truck at the festival, hoping that he would catch up on some sleep for an extra day and wait to meet us until the end of the festival to drive on to the next place. Yeah. And he was still just very tired, and it was like a battle of like him being tired, the bus smelling like asshole,
yeah,
and the sheets weren't changed and like the bus was falling apart and he was like crashing into cars like the whole entire, like scraping the sides, like a window was had to be taped and like the
headlights was one up. So no one could sleep because you were too worried.
We're going to die. And I would text Zeke, my partner, and just be like, I just want you to know that I love you. I just, whatever happens, I'm not high maintenance at all. And thank goodness for the nature of my band. Like, it brought us closer together. But, like, we woke up at one point and, like, the toilet was leaking. So now, like, every time you pee, you have to throw towels on the floor to, like, soak up your own pee.
Yeah.
And then the last straw was when we had like a 6 a.m. ferry.
It wasn't the hitting cars. And
we didn't really have a plan. Like there's no other. It wasn't like, oh, let's just get another thing. At this point, it's like you booked a bus tour.
So what's the last straw?
So the last straw was we woke up in the belly of a ferry because he decided to take the earlier one without telling us, which is illegal and also super dangerous because you're underwater and if you flood and you're asleep, you can die.
Yeah.
But also if we got out of the bus and we got caught, it's like thousands of dollars in fines for being under
there. So he just parked you on the ferry
asleep?
And
didn't tell us.
Uh-huh.
And my son was supposed to be joining us like the following week.
Uh-huh.
So we ended up having to ditch the bus in France. We let the driver go. He didn't really like it anyway. He was so exhausted and he was really bad at his job. And I feel for him.
But
we ended up training it for the rest of the
tour.
And
then the truck just met you there?
And Rod, the truck driver, like saved the fucking tour. Because if he had not been on board, like he was just laughing at the whole thing. His spirit was great. But,
oh my God.
So that was our first tour back. And so, it was pretty rough.
So this is why you're rethinking your future?
Yes. Don't get the Star Sleeper bus.
Parliament had for 6 months?
But then
I guess the first indication would be the relief driver going like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, and I'm shielded from a lot more than that because, you know, everyone's just trying to help me be
keep
in the
it.
Zone, you sure. know, but I'm
so,
like.
So, but I mean, what about you didn't do an American tour at all?
We did. We just finished this last one.
Okay.
About a week ago. We did like a month long tour in the States.
How'd that go?
It was great. I mean,
did you have a better bus driver?
You know, you set the bar low, then you're set up to succeed.
Well, you can't you know, waking up on a ferry. I think anything above that.
Oh, wow, I don't have to throw towels down every time I use the bathroom. Awesome.
That's rough.
Yeah, but
did you have a bus here?
We did. We had so it was Angel Olsen, Julian
Baker. Oh, that's right.
Baker,
I remember. I knew
me.
You did that. Yeah, I knew you.
And then Quinn Christofferson. And so it was three buses.
Yeah.
And we had a semi truck.
Wow, that's big.
Yeah, it was like over 40 people with crew. And
you guys did all right?
Incredible.
Yeah.
Like they ran it, like it was a lot of planning on like management and, you know, production side.
So when you had heard Angel's music, that's a relatively new friendship or?
I mean, we've gotten closer over the years,
and
then COVID brought us closer together.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I bumped into her on tour in Amsterdam in probably 2014.
Yeah.
And that was the first time we, like, hung.
Okay.
And we ended up at the same bar after a show. We had, we both had a show the same night, and we ended up at the same bar, and she pushed the tables together and was like,
that was that.
Come hang.
Yeah. And now you guys are recording music together and touring.
Yes.
And everybody's happy.
Yeah. As happy as, you know, you can be.
Yeah. All right.
But yeah, she's an amazing person and her whole crew is great.
Okay.
And Julian's whole team is wonderful and she's a sweetheart too.
What's her, where's she from? I don't know her stuff.
She's based out of Nashville now.
Uh-huh.
I think she's from Memphis originally.
Is she of the Christoffersons?
She is not.
Okay.
Well, there's a Quinn Christofferson who is the first of four, and he is from Alaska. And Julian Baker, she's the one living in Nashville.
Okay.
And she started playing in like hardcore bands and stuff.
Huh.
And broke out doing a solo record in 2014 or 15.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's just really beautiful, like a great guitar player.
Cool.
Really emotive, you know, talks a lot about addiction and mental health.
Okay.
And, you know, they're just, and her voice is just like crystalline.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So are you just taking it easy right now?
Yeah, I have a few months off now. Yeah. Settling back here. We like moved into a new spot and, you know, we're going to, I think we only have it for 6 months at the moment.
Oh, you're not going to buy a house?
Yeah, now's a really great time.
Is it? No. No. We got to get out of here. There's not going to be any water left.
You know, one thing I read, there's an article about, there's a new sect in psychology about environmental dread.
Oh.
And that's like a real thing happening with people right now and like finding where people's anxiety is coming from. And it's about just
about the environment.
Yeah.
Where is it coming from?
Right. But it's
reality.
Like, yeah. You know, but it's like this, like, it's because that's one thing when you talk about like anxieties that are actually founded.
Yeah.
So then how do you, someone that has anxieties that are actually valid.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you treat that?
Yeah.
Just tell them to honor their fear and do whatever their fear is telling them to do. Get out of town.
Yeah, get the fuck out. I mean, so, I mean.
It's like, oh, yeah, you know what? I understand you're anxious. And you're right. You're right about everything. It's probably not going to end well. So maybe try to get out ahead of it somehow.
Yeah. You know, and like, as a therapist, I feel like it'd be great for the short-term clients. You know what I mean? Just feel like, yeah, you should definitely just go.
Well, yeah, but you, like I did it for myself. You got to put a plan in place that is real enough to not feel like a fantasy to, you know, save your sanity and possibly save yourself. You know, like for me, it was just applying for permanent residence in Canada, like to get that application underway. And it unburdened me in a big way. Like it could take 2 or 3 years for me to be approved. And it just means that I would be able to live there and work and get healthcare, you know, without foregoing citizenship. But it's incentive. And it feels like I've taken some sort of action.
So you've fallen in love with Canada.
Well, I've fallen in love with a pace of existence that doesn't have the psychic cancer that lives here.
Right.
You know, I think getting out ahead of environmental disaster is anyone's challenge.
Right.
Because that seems to be a real thing. But, you know, being in a cultural climate that is not that much different, but a lot less horrendous and dangerous seeming.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just an age thing. I mean, I used to think Canada was boring, but now I'm like, I'm ready to be bored.
Right.
Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah.
I've done the work and I've done, you know, I'm in this, you know, I've peaked in a way. And I've saved some bread. So what do I need to, you know, sit here and wait for weirdos and, you know, like land pirates and freaks to come drag
me out of my
house?
You don't want to bust your ass anymore.
Like, well, it's not even a matter of busting my ass. It's just like I would like to live without the constant fear of our cultural and political climate.
Yeah.
But that was just something I did for myself. And it created a lot of space around those kind of fears, whether it's climate or political anxiety.
What do you do with the space now that you?
I fill it with other depression, with other fears. I have other fears that I can just feel. You know, then like ultimately, it does not placate the omnipresent dying thing.
Right. I mean that like during the last couple of years, like learning how to filter myself in front of my kid with what's actually happening in the world.
I can't even imagine that. Yeah.
And it's been really hard. And he's like, you know, had to meet a whole bunch of new friends like in the midst of pandemic stuff. And
they oddly, it seems to me, not being a parent, but, you know, if you're fair and, you know, protective, ultimately, whatever, you know, the trauma of adjustment is different than, you know, real trauma in a way, right?
Yeah.
And they kind of, they're their own people and they'll process it.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? And I think it's like, for us, it's like, we're honest to a point, but we also want everything is an adventure, you know?
Sure, sure.
So as long as it's like, we're a happy unit and we stay optimistic, then like, he's, you know, he has no idea.
Right. You got to gaslight a kid.
Yeah, sometimes.
All right, it's good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
That was nice. I was happy to meet her, happy to talk to her. got a little heavy there, but that happens here. And the coffee she got me was really good. I would plug it, but I don't remember what it was. There is a coffee shop somewhere who has Sharon as a regular customer saying, fuck, why didn't... The new album is called We've Been Going About This All Wrong. If you're in Australia or New Zealand, she'll be on tour there in December. Go to SharonVanEtten.com for tour dates and info. And hang out for a second, will you? Look, people, if you have a Full Marin subscription, this week we posted a real blast from the past. Those of you who have been with us from the very beginning might remember a segment we used to do on the very first episodes of WTF called A Few with Matthew. Matthew Weiss is a filmmaker, a film editor, a teacher of sorts. I knew him back in the day. He used to... I met him through Sam Cedar when we did Break Room Live, a video streaming show before anyone could stream it on the last incarnation, is that what you call it, of Air America. And he used to shoot bits with me, little directed bits, fake commercials, and also just riffing on the street. And we had kind of a strange, slightly competitive relationship. And he was here in L.A. and came over to visit. So we recorded our first A Few with Matthew segment in over 12 years. Wasn't there a point in our friendship where it was over? In Queens. I remember walking down the street.
Yeah.
And it was like, fuck you with your Alexander technique and your arrogance. I mean, who the fuck
If it wasn't for the Alexander technique, I'd be crippled today. You don't know how badly my spine and neck are fucked up from being an editor and sitting in a chair for 12 hours a day. Oh, sorry.
I remember what it was.
What was it?
It was like, who the fuck do you think you are? You think you know everything about movies?
Right. That was because I believe on the heels of the aforementioned dust up
about
over,
Wild Things.
That was really what did it, huh? I think so. It's hard
you
to
pompous
believe.
Ass.
I know.
Who the fuck are you?
And I've never heard anyone say that to me, so it really came as a shock.
No.
All right. It may have been said to me once or twice. So, but I also recall. The makeup, well, it wasn't makeup sex, but it was the makeup time where you said, and this is all very pre this show
podcast.
Taking off.
Yeah.
It was happening, but it wasn't like what it is today.
Right.
And you said, I'm playing at the beer garden near your house. Remember that show?
Yes.
And it was like...
Terrible.
Five people. I thought it was a funny show. I enjoyed myself.
Yeah.
But it was, I was there to see you.
Right.
And that was after that. We went and ate at the diner. And then it's
at Neptune?
Yeah.
And that was it? And then we were back?
I mean, a little bit.
It wasn't irreparable? But pancakes?
I mean, I don't know. The fact that I'm sitting here talking to you right now should be evidence to the contrary of that.
I always felt that there was, it wasn't tension, but there was some kind of strange ego thing, struggle we had. Yeah. That was my belief.
Yeah.
I don't know what it
was.
Well,
you would think that. You would think that.
Yeah, see that. I know. It's up now, and you can listen to it with the Full Marin subscription, and anyone with a WTF Plus subscription can go back and listen to those early segments at the very start of the archives. Just scroll all the way back to episode 2. Yeah. That's a long time ago. Next week, folks, next week I'm in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on September 16th, Phoenix, Arizona at Stand Up Live on September 17th, Boulder, Colorado at the Boulder Theater on September 22nd, Fort Collins, Colorado at the Lincoln Center on September 23rd, and Toronto, Ontario at the Queen Elizabeth Theater on September 30th and October 1st. Then I'm in Livermore, California at the Bankhead Theater on October 6th. And Carmel by the Sea, California at the Sunset Center on October 7th. I need someone to go to that. That one's on the edge of being canceled. I'll be in London, England at the Bloomsbury Theater Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd. I'll be in Dublin, Ireland at Vicker Street Wednesday, October 26th. I have dates in November and December in Oklahoma City, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Eugene, Oregon, Bend, Oregon, Asheville, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee, all leading up to my HBO special taping at Town Hall in New York City on Thursday, December 8th. There are some tickets still around for that second show. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info, and I'll play us out.
Boomer Lives, Monkey and LaFonda, Cat Angels Everywhere.